Pope Benedict XVI arrives in Cuba today. This comes on the heels of a successful weekend visit to Mexico, where he celebrated Mass with hundreds of thousands and also tackled that country's deadly drug war head on. Cuba might be a testier affair. The communist government has long suppressed the church, and before his arrival, Benedict told reporters, quote, "It is evident that Marxist ideology and the way it was conceived no longer corresponds to reality." This marks just the second papal visit to Cuba. The first was in 1998 by Pope John Paul II. Back then, few Cuban Americans made the pilgrimage across the Florida Straits. But today, there are expected to be hundreds on hand in Santiago de Cuba when Pope Benedict celebrates Mass. From Miami, here's NPR's Greg Allen.
Carlos Saladrigas is well known in Miami's Cuban American community. He's a prominent businessman and co-chairman of the Cuba Study Group, an organization working to make Cuba a free and open society. Today, he'll be in Antonio Maceo Revolution Square in Santiago de Cuba when Pope Benedict celebrates Mass. 14 years ago, it was a different story. Saladrigas helped lead a protest that caused Miami's archdiocese to cancel a pilgrimage planned for John Paul's visit. Like many in the Cuban-American community, Saladrigas felt the papal visit gave legitimacy to a repressive regime. But watching it on TV in Miami, he says he had a change of heart.
It made me realize that I had made a huge mistake in opposing the visit, that the visit was good. It did a lot of good for Cuba and for Cubans. It rekindled hope, although a lot of things haven't materialized. But hope is nevertheless important. And I think this Pope is going to do the same thing. He's going to stress the importance of hope.
Pope John Paul II's 1998 visit led to improved relations between Cuba's Catholic Church and the Castro regime that allowed the church to grow in Cuba. The improved dialogue between the church and the government also was a factor in winning the release of jailed political dissidents. All of that helped convince Saladrigas and others in South Florida's Cuban-American community that the Catholic Church may present some of the best hope for change in Cuba. But in Miami, there are still outspoken Cuban-Americans who oppose the visit.
I don't think it's the church's role to organize pilgrimages where the Cuban regime will decide who gets in and who doesn't.
Ninoska Perez is a radio talk show host in Miami and a director of the hardline Cuban Liberty Council. She points out that in recent weeks, in advance of the Pope's visit, there was a crackdown on dissidents. Cuban authorities arrested more than 50 women, members of the Ladies in White, female relatives of men who are held as political prisoners. Perez says the Pope's visit draws attention away from those government activities.
When then all of a sudden the Pope goes and everything is fine and you're organizing a pilgrimage from Miami, it's like, okay, this is fine. And I think what the Catholic Church should be addressing, both inside and outside Cuba, is the fact that there is violence and repression.
The recent crackdown on dissidents is a concern also to Cuban Americans who support the pilgrimage, people like Andy Gomez. Gomez is a senior fellow at the Institute for Cuban and Cuban American Studies at the University of Miami. He notes that 14 years ago, when Pope John Paul II was in Cuba, he raised the issue of human rights. Gomez hopes Benedict will take the cause further.
I think the Pope, given the actions that just took place, needs to reach out to the Ladies in Whites, invite him to one of the masses, if not both. He needs to recognize, acknowledge the dissident movement in Cuba.
At the same time, Gomez is critical of some within Cuba's Catholic Church, particularly Havana Archbishop Cardinal Jaime Ortega. Ortega recently asked the government to clear a group of dissidents from a Havana church they occupied in advance of the Pope's visit. Miami Archbishop Thomas Winski, who organized this week's pilgrimage, concedes the Catholic Church is trying to walk a very fine and difficult line in Cuba between an open dialogue with the government and actions that accommodate a repressive regime.
The church has been an advocate, but at the same time, it doesn't want to be co-opted into anybody's political agenda, because if it's co-opted into somebody's political agenda, then it cannot play the role of mediator.
Asked whether a papal visit lends legitimacy to a repressive regime, Archbishop Winski laughed. Pope Leo the Great met with Attila the Hun in 452, he noted, saying popes meet with people of all types. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
In Cuba last night, tens of thousands of people crowded the plaza of Santiago de Cuba for Mass with Pope Benedict XVI. The Pope urged Cubans to seek unity and to overcome their divisions. The Pope had arrived in Cuba with a political message, but as Nick Miroff reports from Havana, Pope Benedict seemed to be sidestepping politics yesterday.
Cuban President Raúl Castro greeted Benedict at Santiago's airport yesterday afternoon as the Pope arrived after a 3-day visit to Mexico. He continued into the city, riding in the Popemobile, passing crowds of waving Cubans, and by the evening, the city's Antonio Maceo Plaza was a festive scene with music and building anticipation for what the Pope might say. Cuban state television carried the event live, and speaking from a large blue and white platform built for the occasion by the Cuban government, Benedict read in Spanish from a written text. The spiritual purpose of Benedict's visit is the 400-year anniversary of Cuba's patron saint, the Virgin of Charity, and Benedict said he had come as a pilgrim.
Queridas hermanas y hermanos, doy gracias a Dios.
Benedict's homily urged Cubans to seek a spiritual path to resolving their problems. He encouraged a return to traditional marriage and directed his remarks at Cubans both on the island and abroad.
Luchen para construir una sociedad abierta y renovada.
You must struggle to create an open and rejuvenated society, the Pope said, a better society with more dignity that better reflects God's goodwill. At the outset of his Latin America trip, Benedict told reporters that Cuba's Marxist model no longer corresponds to reality, but he did not directly criticize the Castro government at the mass Monday night. Today he travels to Havana, where he is scheduled to meet with Raul Castro and possibly his brother, though not Cuban dissidents. Benedict may be planning a more politically oriented message for the outdoor mass he will say Wednesday in Havana prior to his return to Rome. For NPR News, I'm Nick Miroff in Havana.
The Haggadah tells one of the oldest stories of all time, when Moses led the ancient Israelites out of slavery in Egypt. The tale is retold every year in Jewish homes around the world during Passover, and in particular over the Passover meal, the Seder. It begins with the lighting of candles, and then a prayer.
You are blessed, Lord God of us, King of the cosmos, who has set us apart with his mitzvot and instructed us to ignite a festival light.
That was author Nathan Englander reciting his own English translation of a traditional Hebrew blessing before the Passover Seder. Englander recently translated the Passover prayer book from the original Hebrew and Aramaic into the new American Haggadah. The project was the brainchild of author Jonathan Safran Foer. Foer and Englander are both novelists who write from a Jewish perspective. Foer's debut novel, Everything is Illuminated, focused on a grandson of a Holocaust survivor. And Englander recently published a new collection of short stories called What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. Both also have fond childhood memories of Passover Seders with their families.
It was a real kind of makeshift cobbled together and really happy affair.
Jonathan Safran Foer.
Something we would always look forward to and something that would always generate a lot of memories.
We used to drink wine.
Nathan Englander.
So I do remember being drunk. Yeah, I used to slide under the table. That's a very famous family quote. I was like four, and I stood up and I said, I be's a drunkard. And they still say that to me a lot.
The Haggadah is the heart of any Passover Seder, as both a guide for prayer and discussion. But Foer thought that something was missing from the prayer books his family used through the years, and he wanted to make a better one.
And there's nothing original about that idea. You know, there's no book in human history that's been revisited more times than the Haggadah. There are about 7,000 editions that we know of, and probably many multiples of that that have been created.
So what was lacking? What in the conversations, what in the debate did you feel was missing?
I did not come from a traditionally observant household. Nobody in my family speaks Hebrew. We relied very heavily on the Haggadah as a user's guide into this holiday, not only to take us through the requisite prayers and songs and stages of the Seder, but also to encourage the kinds of questions we might ask. So when we would speak about the Haggadahs that we used, and we went through many different versions in the course of the Seders of my life, when we would say that the writing was good in one, what we meant was it was good relative to other Haggadahs, as opposed to good as compared to our favorite novels of the year or our favorite, you know, political writing. And I thought, why are we using this kind of diminished standard instead of our very highest standard? And I should say also that in my family, about half the people at the Seder table were writers. So why would we accept, you know, a translation that was unintentionally ambiguous or that was not a clear or faithful translation of the Hebrew?
And speaking of the translation itself, Nathan, this is where you come in. How did Jonathan convince you that this was a project that you should take on, translating Hebrew and Aramaic into English for this new version of the Haggadah?
Yeah, I don't think I could have been any more resistant. You know, this is, I grew up Orthodox and, you know, sort of that way of having left organized religion. I felt just this resistance to it. And he said, go look and think about it. You know, I grew up religious and I only used the Hebrew side. And when I'd opened a Haggadah and looked at the English side of the text, what I saw was this text, and I can't say it enough times, I feel like you should read it and weep. It is so stunning. It is so beautiful. It is just gigantic in a million different ways. And I wasn't seeing on the page what I was hearing in my head. You know, and it took 3 years to do it. I thought we were making the hipster Haggadah and it would be 6 weeks or something and we'd be done. But it became this all-consuming project of just trying as literally as possible to give voice to this text that is so stunning to me. Any beauty that's in the translation is simply a representation of the Hebrew and Aramaic.
Well, and I'll put this to both of you, but it's clear. I hear you talking about how much you love thinking about the words. But I do wonder, did it strengthen, faith isn't the right word, but your religious identity?
I can jump on that. I can't even tell you how my faith and non-faith was made stronger by this, where I came to recognize how much I truly relate to texts, not to organized religion, not to that kind of structure of community.
What about you, Jonathan?
I think I had a slightly different response. Through this project and also having two young kids, I've become more and more interested in the things that religion can do. Is it possible to gather with one's family, extended family, and eat over the course of 3, 4, 5, for some people, 7 hours, while, you know, discussing who we are as individuals, as a community? It's certainly possible to do that without religion, but most people don't do it without religion. The older I get, the more aware I am of my inability to, you know, live the life I want to lead without help, without some kind of structure. I don't know that the question of belief in God is all that important to me. But what is very important to me is the story that's being told and has been told by more than 100 generations of Jews for thousands of years, and the power that the story has in my life and in my family's life.
Jonathan Safran Foer is the editor of the New American Haggadah, which features a new English translation by Nathan Englander. Both writers joined us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Thanks so much to both of you. It's really been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much.
And happy Passover.
To you too.
Chag Sameach.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. There are probably few people in the world who know more about the life of Jesus than Bart Ehrman. He's a New Testament scholar at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where his lectures are among the most popular on campus. And though Ehrman's not a particularly religious man, he's often puzzled by a question he gets asked. Did Jesus exist? So he decided to answer that question in his new book, and fittingly, it's also called Did Jesus Exist? Bart Ehrman, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let's start with a premise of your question, because I hope I'm not giving anything away. Your answer is yes, Jesus did exist.
Yes, that's right.
You don't have to get to the end of the book to get to that answer. But why did you feel like the question needed to be answered at all? I mean, is it in serious dispute?
The deal is that every week I get two or three emails from people asking me, did Jesus exist? And as I started doing some looking into the matter, I realized there is a large contingent of people, largely on the internet, but also writing books, claiming that, in fact, Jesus never did exist, that he was completely made up by the early Christians. And I wanted to approach that question as a historian to see whether that's right or not.
These are people you call mythicists, or I guess they call themselves mythicists. So what is the argument that they make?
Well, there are several arguments that when you just look at them plainly, they look fairly plausible. Jesus is never mentioned in any Roman source of his day. There's no archaeological evidence that Jesus ever existed, no physical proof. And the Christian sources are problematic because the Gospels are 20, 40, 50, 60 years later. Mm. On the other side of the ledger, they point out that many of the things said about Jesus are said about pagan divine beings or pagan gods.
That there was this guy who was a person who was crucified and
he
resurrected.
Did miracles, cast out demons, raised
on water.
The dead. And most importantly, they point out that there are pagan gods who are said to die and rise again. Hmm. And so the idea is that Jesus was made up as a Jewish God who died and rose again. And so when you simply look at it without any context, it looks like a plausible argument.
Why do you think it is implausible then?
A lot of the arguments don't really count for anything. I mean, the fact there's no archaeological evidence for Jesus doesn't really matter, because there's not archaeological evidence for hardly anybody who lived
Moses,
in this world.
Moses, Abraham, on and on.
Well, or the 60 million people who lived in Jesus' day. So what I do in the book is I marshal all of the evidence. The Gospels were written 40 or 50 years after Jesus, but they incorporate earlier written sources, and they're all reliant on oral traditions. Mm. And you can actually translate some of these Greek traditions in the Gospels back into the original Aramaic of Jesus, and they make better sense, which means these were traditions floating around in Palestine probably just a few years after Jesus'
death.
And
we should just make it clear. I mean, the Gospels, according to scholars, these are not eyewitness accounts. I mean, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were written long after Jesus died.
That's right. They're all anonymous, in fact. It was only about 100 years later that people said they were written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Hmm. So they're written by Greek-speaking Christians living decades later. Moreover, we have the writings of the Apostle Paul, who was writing before the Gospels and who converted to be a follower of Jesus just a year or two after the traditional date of his death.
He knew Jesus' brother James.
Yeah, Paul knew Jesus' brother James, and he knew his closest disciple Peter, and he tells us that he did. And if Jesus didn't exist, you would think his brother would know about it. So I think Paul probably is pretty good evidence that Jesus at least existed.
You contend that had he actually been invented by pagans at the time, they would have turned him into this powerful figure of grandeur that was like shooting laser beams out of his fingers rather than a man who was crucified.
The Messiah was supposed to overthrow the enemies.
Right.
And so if you're going to make up a Messiah, you'd make up a powerful Messiah.
Like a superhero.
A superhero. You wouldn't make up somebody who was humiliated, tortured, and then killed by the enemies.
My guest is Bart Ehrman. He's a professor of religious studies at UNC Chapel Hill, and he's got a new book out. It's called Did Jesus Exist? And if you're wondering what the answer is, it is yes. Bart, I a few years ago, I downloaded a series of lectures that, you know, are available in these, like, you see these ads in magazines, great courses, right? And I downloaded your series of lectures on the life of the historical Jesus. And a lot of people listening will know you. I mean, you are the guy, you're the expert on the life of the historical Jesus. So how are we able to build as accurate an account of his life from the existing material?
One of the things I argue is that historians come away with a different view of Jesus from what is popular in the wider culture. So that Jesus doesn't really look like the Jesus you might have learned about in Sunday school or that you hear from a televangelist.
You say he wouldn't recognize himself if he heard that.
No, he wouldn't.
You write that in the book.
He most definitely would not recognize himself if he turned on TV on Sunday morning. Jesus, according to the majority of scholars in North America, Europe, was some kind of Jewish apocalyptic prophet, by which I mean that Jesus believed he was living in an evil age controlled by the forces of evil, but that God was soon going to intervene to overthrow the forces of evil and set up a good kingdom on earth, a good utopian kingdom where there'd be no more pain, misery, or suffering. And this cataclysmic break in history was going to happen within his own generation.
We are, of course, speaking on Palm Sunday, Bart. And as a scholar, how do you sort of begin to assess and analyze what you think is true and what you don't think is true?
Yes. Well, at this point, the mythicists have some right things to say. The Gospels do portray Jesus in ways that are non-historical. There is absolutely non-historical material in the Gospels, as we know, because there are contradictions in the Gospels and discrepancies in the Gospels and completely implausible events in the Gospel. As an example, the idea that's being celebrated on Palm Sunday, that Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey and all the crowds came out crying out, "Hosanna in the highest, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord," celebrating the coming of the Messiah to Jerusalem. If that had really happened the way it's described in the Gospels, there's no way to explain why the Romans didn't have Jesus arrested on the spot. In the Gospels, Jesus spends another week in Jerusalem preaching to the crowds. But anybody who calls himself a Messiah is making a political statement.
He would have been arrested right away.
He would have been arrested right away. And so probably the event would have been a much smaller, toned-down version from what you get in the Gospels. Jesus certainly came to Jerusalem the last week of his life, and he ended up being crucified there. There's no doubt about that. But the way it's celebrated in the Gospels simply is not plausible historically.
Bart, a lot of people listening will know you as a well-known scholar of early Christianity. You are controversial. I should point this out because you are something of a lapsed Christian yourself. You've been described as an agnostic. Is that fairly
accurate?
Yes,
that's right.
So what is your relationship with Jesus about? I mean, is it historian to historical figure? Is there any part of it that is spiritual?
Most of it is historical. Jesus is the most important figure in the history of Western civilization. And so people ask me, well, why would you be interested in somebody you don't believe in? I mean, he's tremendously important. So,
I mean, is Jesus to you what Lincoln is to Doris Kearns Goodwin or, you know?
to a large extent, although I must say that I continue to be attracted by the teachings of Jesus. Jesus' teachings of love and mercy and forgiveness, I think, really should dominate our lives, that it really is better to love your neighbor as yourself. On the personal level, I agree with many of the ethical teachings of Jesus, and I try to model my life on them, even though I don't agree with the apocalyptic framework in which they were put.
That's Bart Ehrman. He's professor of religious studies at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. His new book is called Did Jesus Exist? Bart joined me here in our studios in Washington. Thank you so much for coming in, Bart Ehrman. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.